me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Today's show is a special one. We have Nicholas Matthews, co-founder and CEO of Stillwater Behavioral Health. His personal journey deeply intertwines with his professional mission. After facing numerous challenges related to substance abuse, Matthews found the strength and motivation to overcome his addiction, despite the heartbreak of losing close friends to it. His recovery inspired him to dedicate his life to helping others struggling with similar issues, guiding them towards sobriety and better mental health. Today, he shares his story of transformation, emphasizing the rewards of saving his own life and the life of others who are caught in the grips of addiction. His path is your path to recovery, which begins now. Nicholas, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate the time.
Listen, we are honored to have you. Just in our mere chat that we had before setting this up, tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk. How did you get involved into this work?
Yeah, fair. I mean, look, you know, I think my story is probably just like so many people out there, right? I grew up in a kind of a traumatic household. I shouldn't say kind of, it was a very traumatic household, a very abusive father. I was an only child, and you know, he split when I was a kid. So my mom, who's, you know, she's an angel, did her best. She had to work three jobs to keep the lights on and keep food on the table. So I was left with a lot of time and a lot of pain. And as a kid, I didn't understand what I was doing, right? So I started medicating. That was the truth, right? I think, you know, you kind of see a lot of people when they begin their substance abuse journey, they don't know that they're self-medicating at the time. A lot of times we don't know until we're much older and we go through therapy and recovery and all these other things where we realize that we're self-medicating. And that's what I was doing. You know, I started smoking weed when I was a kid, 11, 12, and then it starts to drinking, and then I'm taking pills. And the progression of it was because I finally felt some sense of peace. You know, I would take these substances, and for the first time, I felt comfortable in my own skin. Right. And again, in hindsight, I didn't realize that. I thought I was just a kid who liked to party but the truth is that I was struggling, and I found these medications. And the problem with the medication like that is that it only works for so long. You know, you start smoking weed and then you build a tolerance and you don't get as high as you used to. So you progress and you progress and you progress. And before you know it, you know, I'm 16, I'm doing heroin, I'm doing crystal meth, I'm doing cocaine. And then that stops working. So then you start injecting it, and that stops working. And it's progressive, man. So, you know, fast forward, I just turned 20 and I was completely strung out. I was 127 pounds soaking wet. I had Hep C, my liver was shutting down. So convicted felon, fast track to nowhere, you know, overdosing quite frequently. Cause again, my liver was shutting down. So I had no physical defense. And thank God this is before, you know, fentanyl was super popular like it is today, because that would have been a wrap. And, you know, ultimately, I think I knew that what I was doing was wrong. And I knew that what I was doing was not what I wanted for myself, but I didn't have the wherewithal or the strength to get out of my own way. And when I was 20, I was in a relationship with a girl who was wildly toxic, and she told me she was pregnant. And all of a sudden I just had this moment of clarity where I realized that if I continue doing this, I'm going to be a dad just like my dad was. And I'm going to carry that cycle. I'm going to be him. I already am him. But right now my actions are selfish and self-centered. I'm not hurting anybody else. But if I bring a kid into this world, I'm going to hurt somebody else. I'm going to perpetuate that cycle. And, you know, I got her into treatment and I went to treatment. you know, she ended up leaving, and she miscarried and moved on with her life. And I stayed sober, man. I went to treatment, and, you know, I tried multiple times prior, right, to get sober. It wasn't like my first shot. I think I'd been to treatment 5 or 6 times, and AA meetings and NA meetings and everything you could mention. But this time, for the first time ever, I was willing to do whatever it took. And what I mean by that is, if you had a day of sobriety, then I was going to listen to you. I had hit a wall. I couldn't tell another lie. I couldn't mislead. I was willing to do whatever it took. And so I just listened to people, man. I moved to Southern California. Never been here before. Got off the plane, went into a treatment center, and been here ever since. You know, I stayed sober, moved into sober living. I got a job waiting tables, and then I found passion working in a treatment center very much like the one that I went to. So I started doing that. I'm working overnight shifts as a technician. And, you know, at that point, you know, I'm a couple years sober. My recovery's starting to take root. And I just did the next logical thing. Truth be told, I'm never trying to sell myself short, but people ask me all the time, how did you get here? You know, at the end of the day, I literally just did the next logical thing. My life is not complicated. It may be rare, you know, to achieve recovery and then build a career for yourself and do all these things. It might be rare, but it's not complicated. I didn't come up with any new ideas. I simply did what people had done before me, and I did the next logical thing. I applied the principles of recovery into every facet of my life. I chose integrity, decency, and honesty above all else. And I progressed. That's where I'm at today. I'm in a position of somewhat control, and I can now give back what was given to me on a very broad scale. And I've just committed my life to doing that, to share this lifestyle with other people.
Well, to you, it may sound like an ordinary story, but I know that listeners who are tapping into this can surely connect and relate to the difficulties of having to overcome this challenge. And it sounds to me that you were willing to hurt yourself as much as you can, but when it came to an innocent life, you were willing to make that ultimate sacrifice. So big up to you, and big up to the lives that make our lives better by making change. And really sorry about your loss and having to have to deal with that. Can you let us in a little bit more around how difficult it is when you're dealing with the illness, like the struggle of addiction itself? Prior to, you know, discovering that you were going to drive this new effort and motivation, but how about the challenges that you do day to day? How difficult is that?
It's the hardest I've ever worked in my life, you know? My job today, I will work a 14-hour day and it doesn't feel like work, but when you're trying to feed an active heroin addiction, that's 24/7 hustle. That's a different animal. You know, I will say, addiction's a very interesting thing. You know, I don't have a drug problem, right? I got a me problem. Mm-hmm. Drugs are the solution. That's the only thing that made me feel better. That was the medicine, right? It's without the drugs, I'm the problem. It's between my two ears. It's the way I exist in the world, the way that I take adversity, the way in which I believe that I am the center of the world. I believe that my problems are the biggest problems in the room. I'm self-centered and self-seeking at my natural core. And, you know, the dope was what allowed me to escape that. But it's a me problem. And I always try and encourage people to remember that when they're facing addiction issues. It's not the drugs. It's you. Now, there's a lot of freedom in that knowledge, because if you know that you're the problem and the problem lies inherent in you, that means that you can also be the solution, right? And there's a lot of freedom in that. So I always try and encourage people. You know, it starts in here. It definitely starts in here. The drugs, that's the easy part. You go into a detox, they take them away, right? You get locked up, you're going to kick dope. It's easy. That's basic math. Take the drugs away from the person. How can you change your relationship with the world? How can you change how you ingest the world around you? And if you can figure that out, that's freedom.
Mm. You know, it sounds to me again that once more, you're willing to put yourself in the line of fire just for the biggest of battles, that's to improve the world in one way, shape, or form. But in listening to how this theory works, is like easier said than done. It's not a scenario where you can just remove yourself from anything. I don't even think work itself, let's not even talk about substance abuse. I also feel that whatever you do too much of can lead you down a path. And this one here, unfortunately, the law, death or illness and things that may come with this are really difficult. I can, you know, commend you and continue to commend you on things of that line, just because when you are trying to heal, it's the amount of people that get hurt in that crossfire too, that you're thinking about, that you're probably motivated by. So again, big up to you and to everyone who's out here trying to do this. Tell us a little bit about how can you balance life and recovery and now try to lead your own life. Like, you're trying to do two things at the same time. You want to be like, okay, I just want to fix this, but I also want to lead a normal life. How difficult is that to balance?
That's a good question. You know, I think it kind of varies, right? I like to think that my recovery is, while it is it's very much a large part of my identity, I like to think that it's more or less a tool, right? And that's what it has become in my life. I like to think these recovery principles, what I'm talking about, whether it's spiritual practice or even just OG stuff, go to AA meeting, you know, whatever it is, we have therapy, we have treatment centers, we've got communities. There's so many things that you can tap into. And I like to think of those as all being individual tools, right? My recovery gave me the blueprints, and then these different practices in my life gave me the tools. I get to decide if I'm going to build a house or not, right? And I think when I first got sober, I remember thinking, man, like, it's going to be difficult. There's so many things I can't do. I can't drink for the rest of my life. And that's why we have all these cliches. You kind of narrow it down one day at a time and all these other things. But ultimately what I recognized is it's always going to be perspective, right? Yeah, I theoretically can't take a drink for the rest of my life. But I also simultaneously, I don't have to escape for the rest of my life. I don't ever have to have a crutch. Recovery is an asset. And the more that I was able to change my relationship with what it is, it didn't feel like a chore. It didn't feel like something that I needed to balance with my regular life. It just became a part of my regular life. I started to recognize that, oh, yeah, I don't get to drink anymore, but I also don't have to drink anymore.
Mm.
Ooh, that's a different thing, right? It's free. It's freedom.
You know, you talked about spirituality and using tools. How was spirituality, or is it still helpful for you, and how do you use it?
Sure. I mean, look, you know, I believe that we are energetic creatures, man. You know, it's a tricky one because there's a lot of religious aspects that come into this play, but recovery is not religious. It's non-denominational. It doesn't adhere to anything. For me, spirituality is about being in tune with something bigger than you. It's that simple, right? When I'm not spiritually connected to something, and I'm not meditating, and I'm not putting any energy putting any effort into the energy in my life, then, like I said, all of a sudden, I'm the most important person in the room. And when I'm the most important person in the room, bad things happen because I don't take other things. Consideration. I don't take the greater good into consideration. So for me, that spiritual practice is a way to disconnect from my own problems and recognize that the world is so much bigger than just me.
Mm.
And it allows me to be truly altruistic and selfless when I try to help other people. So it's critical. It's critical because, you know, the absence of spirituality for me feels like poison. I can tell when I'm spiritually unfit, when I'm dark, man. I feel resentful and I'm frustrated. I feel entitled. There's all these negative emotions that come along with my isolation. And when I can pause and I can ground myself and I can do some spiritual practice, I don't care what it is. You go to church, you can pray, you can meditate, whatever, copy paste, or they're all the same principles, right? You're trying to press into something bigger than you. And if you can get in tune spiritually, you just feel better.
Yeah. So, like, as I am looking at this from a listening standpoint, it sounds to me you really don't know or come prepared to understand what the day will look like as you're doing this battle. You begin to build these tools and say, I'm going to try to use this to support me today. It's like packing lunch. This is the type of meal I'm going to try to be on. This type of diet, I'm going to do this to do that. It's that kind of thing. And what's different about this is the imbalances that may or may not come with it. So it is so much to kind of take in. And your story just as lovely, just as others. Me personally, I've had family members who have struggled with substance abuse. It's not the best of situations when you think of it from that perspective, because no one is clear of anything. We are all in some sort of difficult situation. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be the ultimate difficult, but some of us are layered with substance abuse. Some of us are layered with the lack of empathy to others and so on. So there's so much that can impact how we relate ourselves to others. I want to like touch base a little bit about what are some of the scenarios that you consider are going to be helpful for someone who enters. Because I think that when I heard you say you began at an early age, you really didn't have any support groups. How important is there to have supports as you're going through this world of withdrawal?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a firm believer. I think community is everything, right? That's why Southern California was so special to me. And I grew up in a very small town in Oregon, and there's recovery there. There's, you know, AA's everywhere. There's community everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I came to this city, and all of a sudden I walked into a meeting and I would see a guy that looked like me. You know, prior to that, I would see these old grizzled alcoholics that were 40 years older than me and didn't care what I had to say. And I never felt like I fit in. All of a sudden, I would see these guys that they had what I wanted. They got the girlfriend in the car and all this other, like, I want that. This is crazy. That community was so critical for me because it made me feel like I wasn't alone. And addiction is the opposite of connection, right? That's what addiction is. It's the most isolated that a person can be. And this is true for a lot of mental health issues outside of just addiction, right? You suffer from severe depression, generalized anxiety, things of that nature. It can feel very, very isolating. The moment when you realize that there are other people who have the same problems that you do, and that you're not nearly as special or unique as you maybe thought you were before, now all of a sudden you have a community and you have examples of what to do. You have support. For me, it was critical. And I always encourage people, find your community. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, like I mentioned before, you know, I identify as an alcoholic, but drinking was never my problem. I'm a heroin addict. But when I went into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went into recovery groups and I went into treatment centers that had other people, I realized, oh, alcohol, heroin, crystal meth, they copy paste. It didn't matter what we were struggling with. The solution was the same. That community, that sense of involvement is a game changer for a lot of people, man.
Mm. You know, you bring in community, and community is big, not only on this platform, but in the world that we live. You have to have someone you can match with. You may have sat there with wiser people. You may have sat there with OGs and people who understood the battles. And look, if you did this, that, and you could have a connection. But I think that you said, I felt energy. I felt a certain way when I clicked with people who were not only looking like me, but they sounded and viewed the world from my eyes as well. Because I think that the best way to look at a perspective, all due respect to how things are, back in the days when this was just in its infancy, where we were just introduced to this, it was coming from other places of the world, we were just hitting on this, it wasn't as cultural as it is now. Now you could literally hit groups throughout the world, log in, some of us can do it online, others connect in person, some of us do a combination of that. So there's a lot to be said about the avenues and possibilities that we can utilize today that were probably not available to us, you know, before. I want to talk more now about you and Stillwater. What are you most proud about this venture? And tell us how you got involved from being the technician to how you hit this up.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, developing Stillwater was always kind of my biggest dream. I always wanted to have, you know, my own treatment center, my own program that I knew worked, right? At the end of the day, you know, this is the medical field, right? So there's regulations, there's rules, there's licenses. You know, you walk into any hospital in the country, you know you're in a hospital. They all kind of feel sort of similar, but you and I both know the difference between a good one and a bad one. Mm. It always boils down to the people. It always boils down to the staff. I can go into a really great hospital, but if my nurse is bad and my case manager's bad, my experience is bad. The people, the culture are what's important. So, you know, when I started working in this field, you know, like I said, as a technician, I'm walking around doing rounds, I'm giving out medications, I'm just checking on kids, playing ping pong, making sure that they're okay. It was a very easy job, but it was something that I felt it was important because I could share my experience with these kids. And as my career progressed, I start working in the admissions departments, and then I work as, you know, clinical case manager, and ultimately I find a knack for compliance where I could start navigating the state regulations and national regulations under like the Joint Commission and things like that. And I started a consulting firm where I'm consulting for other centers, so just trying to make people as good as they can be. And through that experience, I really got to learn exactly what worked and what didn't work. I got to consult with some of the largest programs in the country, from Florida to Massachusetts to here in Southern California to Washington and all over. And I got to start to operate on more of a national scale and got to see, oh, that's what these guys are doing. And oh, there's a new therapeutic practice that they're doing on the east side that is incredible and we haven't heard about it yet. So I got these kind of plugins, and that afforded me two things. It afforded me the financial freedom to invest in myself. You know, I worked hard through that consulting and I was able to invest in myself and start my own program. And in addition to that, it gave me the experience to make sure that anything I put in my program, I genuinely believed it. And then I got to start hiring staff. And when you do that, like I said before, you know, Stillwater's a great program. It's got very little to do with me, right? At this stage in my career, I'm not there every day. I'm not running groups. I got program directors and clinical directors and psychiatrists and clinical counselors and yoga instructors and boxing instructors and chefs and all these people. They are what makes Stillwater great. As they're there every day, and you can walk into that place and you can feel safe. You can feel it. It's a vibe. It feels like, wow, this is a place that I could heal in. Like I said, it's got nothing to do with me. That's them. And they've cultivated that environment. And I think that's what we should always be looking for, right? This is, you should always be looking for good people who genuinely care about you, and the care and compassion is prevalent in everything that they do. And that's what Stillwater stands for.
You know, such a beautiful location. And for our listeners, it's Stillwater, just as you hear it, STILL, water spelled out, treatment.com. There's so much to look at your site, so many beautiful articles and pieces that you've kind of put together. But again, I keep hearing culture. I keep hearing community in what you do. And even today, you sound like the most humblest person I've probably met, because at this stage of the game, you admit, I can't be there. I'm not the one in the trenches setting this up, but the vision is there. And you always impact from a leadership position, no matter what. I've always told people, no matter the line of work that you do, you can make a bigger change. And I think that you took this on to make that happen. So super proud of that for you and for people who do venture and visit you. Tell us a little bit about treatment. When people visit your location, how is that assessed? Is it okay, no matter if the person can pay for it, that's what you're looking for? Is there a screening? How does this work?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, treatment is medical in nature, right? I'm a first stop, right? Meaning like I do detox. I'll take people you could have been using this morning. And we'll take you into the facility. So it's a medical facility, nursing staff, physicians, the whole shebang. Licensed by the state, accredited by the Joint Commission on a national scale. So it's a duality of what we were talking about earlier, right? Which is recovery is very, very different from treatment. You don't need to leave treatment and be in recovery. Treatment is it's designed to keep you safe from yourself and to get you off of these dangerous substances or take you out of a dangerous position where your mental health is affecting you adversely, right? Suicidal ideation, things of that nature. It's sort of a subacute, like the last stop before you wind up in the emergency room. That's kind of a good way I like to put it. So there's a lot of assessments, right? There's you know, you would reach out basically, for example, if you wanted to go to Stillwater, you call the 800 number on there and an admissions counselor is going to answer. And it's always a person, you know, there's a little, you know, call system. You want to speak to somebody, press one kind of a thing, but you always get answered by one of our admissions counselors. you know, at that point, they're going to ask you who you are, what are you struggling with? And they're going to assess initially, are you treatable at this level of care? Meaning, you know, is it safe? Can we bring you in? Can we sort of make sure that we can deliver? Where are you at in the country? We fly people in from all over the world to come into treatment. So it's a pretty large operation in that respect. You do the assessment. And again, that's going to cover a lot. It's going to cover what substances are you abusing? What's your experience like? Any diagnosis we should know about, physical concerns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, my facility, you know, we accept insurance. So we would generally get your insurance information and make sure that you have the right benefits. We also have multiple locations with different insurance contracts. I try to make it as easy and as accessible for people as possible, right? I mean, treatment it's expensive, man. This is like an inpatient, you know, you're in there, you got a chef, 24-hour staff. These are not, it's a shame. It's a shame just like anything else in this country. It's the byproduct of a for-profit healthcare system is, you know, therapists, psychiatrists, doctors, they're not cheap. So I've tried to create an environment that wasn't all about, you know, oh, write a check. We generally do the assessment and start the intake process long before, you know, we come to any sort of financial agreements, if you will. And again, I have different locations with different, like, oh, we don't accept that insurance here, but I do over at this location. And maybe it's the house isn't, you know, as extravagant, but you get the exact same meat and potatoes in terms of clinical service. And then they schedule the intake. You know, you come in, you get searched, you come in, you get your initiation, meaning, you know, you sign a bunch of paperwork, you get acclimated, you get a tour, you get meals, you meet with the doctor, you get your medication ordered, and we get you integrated right into the program.
Yeah, sounds like that first stop, that one-stop feel is there. How common is it for someone to come from another location? Let's say someone is dealing in a situation at another state, let it be New York, let it be Portland, let it be a city, wherever. How common do you see people visiting your location when they're at another place that they live?
Well, look, that is wildly common. Even like I said, in my story, right? I went to treatment 15 minutes away from my house 5 times.
Mm.
I couldn't do it. I needed a change of environment. I needed new people, places, and things. I needed an opportunity to reinvent myself. Southern California is special, right? It's special. It's beautiful. The weather's incredible. And the attitude toward recovery is an asset here. It's not a defect. Nobody's going to hold that against you. And that was my experience when I got here was, I didn't know that you could go into a meeting and there'd be 200 people in there and that they would have dances and they would laugh and have fun. I didn't know that that existed. And there's a lot of places in this country where it still doesn't. It's a stuffy meeting hall and you know, it's not the same. And a lot of places in this country, I've gone, like I said, I've experienced programs all over the place and some of them are very institutional. California is unique in that you can license a residential home and get it licensed as a medical facility. So what you see is a house. You get a room in your own bathroom and you're comfortable. You got a TV in your room. It's not, you don't feel like you're in a hospital. You don't feel like you're in a, you know, in an institution. And so I get people from all over the country all the time because they need those three things. They need the change, the people, places, and things. They need an opportunity to reinvent themselves. And they need a community that is going to support them where there's a ton of opportunity. Southern California, you know, it does it. That's where my headquarters is. And I have every intention to expand out because I know that it's not reasonable for everybody to go out of state for a month or whatever. But as it stands now, that is just what the doctor ordered for a lot of people in this country.
Let me just begin by telling our listeners, you know, Southern Cal, we're talking about 113 degrees, y'all. This ain't nowhere to play with. And being honest with you, those of us that can take the heat, let's get it. You know, at the end of the day, you are a phenomenal person for handling this work, for being open about the situation. That transformation doesn't happen for everyone on that first shot. 5, 6, 7. Some, unfortunately, don't even make it. Let's talk about the most difficult cases that do come, or difficult case. What has been the most difficult for you just in that first run when a person enters there? And how do you guys handle that?
Well, look, I just want to make something clear as we get into this, because this is so, so serious, man. I don't have enough fingers and toes to tell you how many clients I've had that have left my program or never made it in. People die. This is serious, right? We had, 108,000 overdose deaths in the last year from fentanyl. It's more than we've ever had. Mm-hmm. There were 75,000 people at the Super Bowl last year. So imagine that entire arena of people from all across the country, every walk of life, 18 years old, 15, 12, 13, 80. It didn't discriminate at all. And it kills people. It's not a game. And those are always the worst cases, right? When you hear whether somebody relapsed and they don't make it back, or the ones who call in and say, oh yeah, I got to do a couple things. I got bills. I'm going to take care of this and I got to take care of that. And I'll come in on the first, and they don't make it to the first. Those are the worst ones always, cause they're all good people, man. That's always the worst part about this job, is that, it's a tough population to love, because you think objectively they're doing this to themselves, right? It's hard to have compassion like you would for like a cancer patient, because they don't have a choice in the matter. And then you see an addict and they're using, and they keep using the drug. And if you can humanize them and remember that they're medicating for a much deeper problem, you stop blaming them and you realize that these are some of the most creative, kind, amazing people you'll ever meet in your life. It's life and death out there for a lot of people, unfortunately.
You know, it is something to marvel at how you peel off these layers of people when they're dealing with these kind of issues. And even the family sector, when families throw you out, they put you in a situation that they can't handle you. And some of those situations are hard to manage. So in this case, the type of cases that we see, that people that do make it to your doorstep, fortunately, some get a chance to turn it around, and some still are a work in progress. I believe that there is opportunity for all kind of areas, but again, you need to have the right mindset, and listening into you share about, listen, I'm not here to judge, I'm not here to say. I'm also here trying to kick it myself, and I stay focused on this because I know how serious this is. It is important for us to understand how difficult it is for a person to deal with this years upon years. And many of our guests that I have had on my platform have openly talked about the struggles of dealing with any type of addiction. Mm-hmm. And this includes even eating or dieting or so many areas that we can focus on. I think that as we listen to this battle, we continue to send positive energy your way into locations such as yours, because some of us are really cut out to do this. And I think that you and your company are really onto something and sending positive ways that you can continue to branch out and reach other areas. Thinking about the ways of this, though, and we talk about these situations, how difficult is it to kind of see a family or someone who makes a referral, they go into your location, and now they're back into that relapse? Do you start from zero again? You start from where they last left off? How is that?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, look, I not everybody, not relapse is not a part of everybody's story. And, you know, it says right there on my website, you see if one of the first things it talks about is individualized treatment. And that's the same, it's going to be the exact same thing. If you leave and you relapse, not only will we be ready to help you out and there's not going to be any judgment, but what we do and how we do it is going to be dictated on an entire team of people making these decisions, right? It's going to be, it varies from person to person. It could be, we recommended that you go and continue intensive outpatient programs and you continue therapy and you do XYZ, but you didn't, you went right back to the same environment. So we can now isolate down that was the decision. Just because you relapse doesn't mean that you unlearned everything that you learned over the course of 30, 60, 90 days in treatment. You don't forget it. You know, I know people, happened recently. I saw a guy at my home group AA meeting that I still go to, and he had relapsed after 14 years. And he came back in, a month later. He's like, and he talked about what happened, but he didn't forget how to stay sober. He knew what that 14 years still felt like. It doesn't wash that away. And that's what we always encourage people. It's okay. If relapse is a part of your story, it's okay. You didn't unlearn what you learned that got you here. All we need to do is now fine tune and try to understand where you went wrong and what part of your thinking was still a little bit broken and what decision led you into an unsafe environment. And hopefully we can figure out that recipe. So if you do come back, we can make sure that you set off on the right path.
I got a great friend I always tap into. She says, it's okay to not be okay. And we're dealing with this every day, all of the time, at all hours. One little thing, one path. I left early and I thought I was making it work. There was an accident. Like, you never know what and where things are going to happen. For me, I continue to look at the lens of what are the trends that you are seeing? What is different when you were in recovery that you're trying to instill at your location now that was not probably prevalent then?
Yeah. You know, again, I think there's a sense of urgency now with fentanyl. If I'm being honest, there's more pressure than it was when I first got sober. If I see somebody coming in today that's just a heroin addict, I'm like, good for you.
Mm.
Fentanyl is the most insidious, dangerous thing I've ever seen in my entire career. And I mean, it puts the fear of God into me, if I'm being honest. You know, I think the landscape of treatment is always changing, but the principles are always the same, right? From when I got sober to when, you know, people started going to AA meetings back in the 30s when Bill and Bob first invented this thing. It's always been the same. And if you have it, you have it. And if you don't, you don't. I think that, you know, when you go into a treatment center, certain things might change. Maybe they got new machines. Maybe there's a new type of therapy that they're implementing. Maybe there's a new type of group. But at the end of the day, people helping people is always going to be the most effective way, right? So we try to keep some of those old school approaches alive, which is, you know, most of my staff, they're all in recovery themselves. Not everybody, right? Sometimes you need a normie's perspective, you know, you don't want to. But we do have, we have people from all different walks of life. We have a very diverse staff of people that can share their experience, because you never know who you're going to resonate with. And that always seems to be the pillar of the most effective way to treat somebody, is you got to connect first. You got to learn how to trust me. You got to know that I'm not lying to you. I'm not trying to sell you nothing. Believe me, I'm not saying this stuff for my health. You can trust my words. At that point, then we can get creative and we can start to implement, you know, EMDR therapy and brain spotting and TMS therapies for, you know, transcranial magnetic stimulation to help with depression. There's all kinds of cool cutting edge stuff that we can do. But first things first, you got to trust me.
Mm. And many say that before the trust comes, you got to deal with this layer, right? You cannot do any of that without getting off or trying to stay sober first, like that opportunity. And then the other pieces start to follow. What about trends? Are there languages that your program is discovering? Like, man, I think we're going to start leaning more into Spanish or some other type of language to support some trends that you're seeing, or no?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, absolutely. Southern California, like we talked about, this is Los Angeles, man. There are people from all over the entire planet here. So we always want to be open to different cultural influence. You know, I'll be honest, it is tough because the majority of my staff members are specialty staff members, meaning they're specialists first. So it would be very easy for me to go out and find an entire staff of Spanish-speaking people. But it starts to become more complicated when I need a doctor who has a DEA registration and certified in addictionology, and then also, you know, does these things. Now, I do have staff members that do, you know, speak Spanish. I've got staff members that speak American Sign Language. We try to always do our best to make it as inclusive and as open as possible. And like you said, with trends, trying to make sure that we are fully prepared to treat anybody when they come in, regardless of, again, age, socioeconomic status, demographic, none of that stuff is taken into consideration. But we also want to be realistic. If I've got somebody coming through and they only speak Russian, and I'm going to be, their treatment experience is not going to be as effective because I don't have the right staff. I'll be the first to tell you. It's our responsibility to let people know when they're not a good fit for us.
Yeah, and big up to you to be able to look at that, not at the dollar sign, more at the refine for the people who are entering your place of venture. Mm. For me, I'm also thinking about the surroundings around mental health and those of us who are dealing. in this type of situation, substance abuse is an umbrella so much to follow, and mental health is nearby with it. You can't tell the difference almost. It's just like, am I having a situation of an urge, or is it I'm going to go back to use it? Is the mental health piece going to overcome this versus that? How difficult that is. And when you think about the mental health piece, how has that kind of encompassed your thought process and your mindset to what you're trying to do here?
Well, look, you know, that's one thing that I'm so proud of. You know, I think this country and our view on mental health and our willingness to embrace people and identify mental health as being important has changed dramatically over the last 20 years, but in particular in these last 10 years, it has grown so much. I remember being a kid. I remember being younger, being in active addiction. It was not okay to have feelings. I was a young man. You can be sad. You can have depression, you know, buck up, like whatever. It was this culture of a masculinity that you had to project out into the world. And it was so critical because people would judge you otherwise. Now, you know, I'm not kidding. This is a real example. I made note of it. I was talking to people about it just a couple of days ago. I was at the gym and, you know, I'm in the locker room getting ready to hop in the steam room. And there's a bunch of cats in there talking about their depression. And they're talking about, oh, I see my therapist over Zoom. You should talk to her. She's great. And these are big, burly, 250-pound guys that have been lifting weights for the last 2 hours. And they're in a locker room. You know, you would not expect that was the conversation to be having. I remember like kind of getting a little bit swollen with pride because I've tried to be as forthcoming about my mental health deficiencies as possible. I've suffered from depression since I was a little kid. And it's not voluntary. It's got nothing to do with my character. It doesn't make me weak. Being in tune with my emotions and being willing to embrace them and address my mental health, it doesn't make me frail. It doesn't make me small. It doesn't make me less than. And I think that our entire culture is starting to catch up to that a little bit, which makes it a safer place to experience these problems and communicate, right? And tell people, I have anxiety. I'm anxious. I don't know what to do with it. It's driving me to want to do these other things. So I'm grateful because as chaotic as this country is right now and as divided as we are and as many problems as we have, there is also this underlying sense of, hey, we're all in this together. Post-COVID has been wild. People have been really so much more open about, hey, it's like you said, it's okay. It's okay to not be okay. It's all right. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody's going to judge you. It's all good.
You know what? All emotions matter. And it's funny enough, back in the day, people are scrutinized for saying, I'm going to a psychiatrist. Now is actually sexy. I'm going to my therapist. Mm-hmm. I got things to do. I put this on the line. You're at work. I have my own OCD about this. I have my ADHD about that. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to look at the goodness of that because when people are forthcoming, when they're open to share out, I think that the world now, we get a better sense as to what to do. How difficult is that to walk into a location and you're guessing just by the person, what they look like and what they are dressed like. Oh, I'm assuming, but this person is openly sharing with you, this is how I deal, this is how I work. And I think that that really is important for us. Tell us about what stories or people or a case that has moved you that when you think about it, you're saying to yourself, Nicholas, man, thank God for this situation. It could be your own survival. It could have been someone else. Is there a particular case that when you think of it, and how dense or difficult it was, it has helped you now in Stillwater and probably making this movement better?
Yeah, I mean, look, I can think of one. I want to be mindful. I'm not going to say names here just because of anonymity. But I had one kid who came in, 19 years old, probably. I think when he first admitted, I remember he came in just a mess, you know. And I saw a lot of myself in him. He was strung out doing dope at warrants all over the country. It was just, you know, trouble. He's not a violent kid, but stealing things and trying to feed his addiction. But he was a good kid. And he came in for a week, left against medical advice, goes relapse, comes back in, stays for a week. I go and meet with him, say, look, man, I'm not gonna let this is not a revolving door. You know, you either need to stick it out or I'm not gonna be able to I can't co-sign this behavior. I'm gonna be enabling if I keep letting you just come in and leave, keep coming in and leave. So I shoot him straight. And he ends up staying and then, you know, get 6 months sober, moves into sober living, and then 9 months sober, then a year, then comes back to me, hey, Nick, I have a job. And then he starts working for me as a tech, just like I did. And he's working the program that he went to. And then he's helping other people. And Then he goes on, he starts his own sober living. And now he owns a sober living, which is like a lower level of care from what I have. It's just it's a community. People that all live in the same house, kind of like a transitional housing. And he runs meetings and, you know, recently asked me to go back to a sober living to go speak. They do a weekly meeting, and I go in there and I'm looking around and I see, you know, 12 of these faces were people that had gone through my program. And what I did, he has now done. He has now his own little community, and he's got it. Buddy, when I tell you like that kind of stuff, I recognize. I mean, look, here's the truth, right? Stillwater, the name Stillwater comes from a Grateful Dead song, Ripple by the Grateful Dead. And in there, they talk about ripples in Stillwater. That's a line in the song. And I've always considered, you know, everything we do has ripples. It affects the people all around us. And when you're at active addiction, when your mental health is down and you're not taking care of yourself and you're not okay, those ripples are negative. And it could be something small. You're on your way to work. You had a bad day. You got a fight with the wife, whatever. You're now road raging at somebody. You're honking at them. You're screaming at them. You don't know what that person is going through. Now they're upset. They're going to carry that to the next person and so on and so on. And it matriculates through the world. Stillwater was always built on the idea we're putting out positive ripples. If I can share a little bit of strength and hope with you, then you might go share a little bit of strength and hope with somebody else. And before you know it, 5 degrees of separation, somebody on the other side of the country is being influenced by a positive thing that you had done. Whether it's a culture that you've started, a community that you drive, whether it's just a random act of good kindness that you're doing to somebody. That pay it forward mentality is so prevalent in this community. And when I get to see stuff like that, the absence of ego, I don't feel like I'm responsible for it, but I just see, oh, this works. This works. There's proof in the, these people are changing their lives. That's why I do it every day. It's those moments, you know.
What a lovely story. And to think of it, seeing yourself in the image of a younger version of you is almost like telling the younger you had you when you were dealing to kind of say, hey, I'm going to give it to you straight. We got to do this. In your story, the change happened because someone said, now you're going to be responsible for this. In this case, you said, I'm making you responsible of this. Make a choice. Incredible how the life goes and you being able to speak to these faces and voices that look like you, that look like us, and you're making that connection. Incredible story. How do you take care of self? Like burnout, 14, 15 hour days. What do you do to take care of thyself?
Man, my self-care regimen is exactly what I tell other people to do. I got a therapist, right? I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll blow my own anonymity. I don't care. Actually, my meeting's tonight. Every Thursday night, it's my home group meeting. And it's like clockwork. If I don't go, I don't feel right. I go, I'm around the same people. I have routine in my life, right? I wake up at the same time every day. I make my bed first thing. I meditate almost every single morning to try and center myself. I have a regimen, and it's not that complicated. I can do it anywhere in the country. You know, I can travel out to New York for the weekend and go hit a meeting. I can go to Hawaii for the week, go hit a meeting there. There's people. I can always find my people. But at the end of the day, there's these little things that I do for myself. Like I said, I'm active in therapy. I don't think that I'm fixed. You know, in December, God willing, I'll take 11 years sober. And, you know, like I said, I don't think I'm cured. I know that I'm not cured. I know that I'm still the problem, and I still have to kind of continue to stay diligent. You know, I do my best to practice what I preach. I don't tell anybody to do anything I don't do myself.
Incredible. Incredible. Right now, what are you currently working on, friend? I know you plan on expanding a bit. What's on your mind?
You know, that's a good question, man. I feel like at a certain point, Stillwater will be as big as it can be. And what I mean by that is when I talked earlier about what makes it valuable, it's the people. Well, I can go off and become a corporate thing where there's a Stillwater in every major city of the country. But I feel like if I do that, my product starts to get tainted a little bit because I don't have the same ability to guarantee those beds and to guarantee that community, that culture that we talked about. So, you know, I do a lot of different stuff. I got a pharmaceutical distribution company that I'm part of. I got a company called Align Wellness that does personalized repetitive TMS therapy to treat people with Parkinson's and autism and depression and concussion protocols. We do EEGs of the brain and we scan and we, you know, we do all this incredible stuff to help people. So everything I do, I try to keep it centered around the same goal of helping people, but recognizing that not everybody that struggles the way that I struggle. So, you know, I try to expand and open my mind. And at the end of the day, I'm a constant student. I am a perpetual student. I'm always seeking education, new exciting ways that I can enhance my treatment center, that I can start new businesses, that I can bring more, you know, to the table. And so, you know, that's what I do. I find things that excite me and I seek education. I seek knowledge.
You talked about a story that kind of resembled yours. For those of us who are trying to set up a business, like your line of work, you got into a passion, something that you felt there was still work to do, and you nicely aligned your life to follow and become the co-founder and CEO of a beautiful location and ongoing. What advice do you have for people when they're trying to start their own business? What are some of the things that you've dealt with?
Yeah, I mean, look, I just touched on, it takes a tremendous amount of humility to start a business. And what I mean by that is you have to be willing to embrace what you don't know. You know, some of the biggest and most successful entrepreneurs in the world, these are guys that never went to college, right? They're not, you look at some of them, some of the richest people on the planet Earth, they were willing to embrace what they didn't know. And that seems to always be, you know, I talk to a lot of successful people in my life. I surround myself with people who have what I want. So I'm constantly being educated on these principles. And when I first started my company, I didn't know how much I didn't know. I didn't know balance QuickBooks. I knew what I wanted to make, but I didn't know how payroll taxes and systems worked and this and that and business credit scores and all this different. I didn't know any of that. And so I had to be willing to, you know, go against my natural instinct, which is to kind of fake it to make it. And I had to be willing to embrace what I didn't know and seek that education. And the most successful businesses I know are generally steered by somebody who has their nose in a book, who has their ear to a podcast. They're listening to somebody, that they're taking advice, that they're open to it. You know, if you think that you are the smartest guy in the room, then you're never going to learn anything. And there's always going to be somebody out there that can teach you something. And I like to think that every person that I come across, I can learn something from. That is a game changer when you want to start a business. Embrace it. Embrace that you don't know. Because if you don't know something, that's freedom. That's how you can grow. If you know everything in the world, you're never going to grow, man. That sounds like a horrible place to be. And your business will reflect that.
It is an amazing way of approaching life. Your easy way and humble way of communicating. There's loads of work to get this done. I love your approach. I love that you continue to stay working with what does work and keep adding the ingredients to make that happen. And I feel that if you decided to say, hey, listen, tomorrow I'm going to sell vacuum cleaners, you'll probably be successful too, because you have the recipe, you have the ability to say, look, I'm not going to leave my comfort zone, but I'm willing to take risks if I know I feel this. And if I feel it and I believe in it, this is what we need to do. Before I let you go, my friend, the floor is yours. What do you want to talk about that's happening, the movement, and what's coming up for you?
Well, I appreciate that. You know, look, I like to, any time I have an opportunity to speak to somebody, especially on a forum like this, I just want to reiterate this. It's dangerous out there. You are not alone. I promise you, I know that this is the most isolating thing. I remember thinking so adamantly that, nah, that's never going to work for me. They don't know how sick I am, or, oh, you know, I'm way worse than these guys, or they're way worse than me. I was constantly looking for differences. But I promise you, this is going to sound rough, but if you're out there and you're feeling alone, you're not that special. There is a whole squad of us that know exactly what you're going through. And there's always going to be somebody who is willing to help. The hardest part of this journey is picking up that phone the first time. Once you do that, it's real. You might have a suspicion. Maybe I'm drinking too much. Maybe I'm abusing this. Maybe I'm doing that. But when you start picking up phones and calling people, it's real. That's the hardest part. I promise you that it is all downhill from there. When you get somebody to answer that phone and they can help you, the hard part's over. at that point, it's just the next logical step of doing what other people have done many, many times before you. So you're not alone. Pick up the phone, find the courage, and don't die. Be safe. Reduce your harm. Get Narcan. Pay attention. Be safe and help one another out there.
Amazing stuff, Nicholas Matthews. Thank you so much. You are not alone. They say you will never make it, and I always say that's questionary. You made a ton of mistakes. And you know what? That's legendary. You stayed Ray Charles to all those comments. And this is what you did to move forward, because you are a visionary, forward thinking. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Nicholas, thank you so much, bud.
Thank you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.